They were alone in the bedroom. Baby John's cot had been removed to the small dining room next door, since he had begun to show an interest in everything that looked like a good romp, hanging on the edge of his cot with shouts of applause and approbation, and then trying his utmost to scale the wooden railings and join the play. Now they were enjoying those contented minutes between love and sleep, talking softly in the candlelight under a single sheet, lying on their sides facing each other, holding close, with their lips almost touching as they murmured together. "But, darling Mark, it is still a thatched hut, and it is still wild bush."
"It's a big thatched hut," he pointed out.
"I don't know. I just don't know if I've changed that much."
"There's only one way to find out. Come with me."
"But what will people say?"
"The same as they'd say if they could see us now."
She chuckled easily and snuggled a little closer. "That was a silly question. The old storm speaking. People have said all there is to say about me, and none of it really mattered a damn. There aren't a lot of people out there to sit in judgment. Only Pungushi, and he's a very broad-minded gentleman." She laughed again sleepily. "Only one person I care about, really. Daddy mustn't know. I've hurt him enough already."
So storm came at last to Sharker's gate.
She came in the beaten and neglected Cadillac, with John on the seat beside her, her worldly possessions crammed into the cab or strapped on the roof, and Mark riding his motorcycle escort ahead of her over the rude and bumpy track. Where the track ended above the Bubezi River, she climbed out and looked around her. "Well," she decided after a long, thoughtful survey of the towering cliffs, and the river in its bed of green water and white banks, framed by the tall, nodding strands of fluffy-headed reeds and great spreading sycamore figs. "At least it's picturesque."
Mark put John on his shoulder. "Pungushi and I will come back with the mules for the rest of your gear." And he led her down the footpath to the river. Pungushi was waiting for them under the trees on the far bank, tall and black and imposing in his beaded loincloth.
"Pungushi, this is my lady, and her name is Vungu Vungu, the Storm.
I see you, Vungu Vungu. I see also that you are misnamed," said Pungushi quietly. "For a storm is an ugly thing which kills and destroys, and you are a lady of beauty."
"Thank you, Pungushi," Storm smiled at him. "But you also are misnamed, for a jackal is a small, mean creature."
"But clever," said Mark solemnly.
And John let out a shout of greeting and bounced on Mark's shoulder, reaching out with both hands for Pungushi.
"And this is my son."
Pungushi looked at John. There are two things a Zulu loves dearly, cattle and children. Of the two, he prefers children, preferably boy children. Of all boy children, he likes best those that are robust and bold and aggressive.
"Jamela, I should like to hold your son," he said,
and Mark gave John to him.
"I see you, Fimbu," Pungushi greeted the child. "I see you, little man with a great voice."
And then Pungushi smiled that great beaming radiant smile, and John shouted again with joy and thrust his hand in Pungushi's mouth to grab those white shining teeth. But Pungushi swung him up onto his shoulder and laughed with a great hippo snort and carried him up the hill. And so they came to Sharka's gate, and there was never any doubt right from that first day. Within an hour there was a polite tap on the screen door of the kitchen, and when Mark opened it there stood in a row on the covered stoop all of Pungushi's daughters, from the eldest, who was 14, to the youngest of 4.
"We have come," announced the eldest, "to greet Fimbu."
Mark looked at Storm inquiringly, and she nodded. The eldest daughter swung John up onto her back with a practiced action and strapped him there with a strip of cotton limbo. She had played nursemaid to all her brothers and sisters, probably knew more about small children than both Storm and Mark combined, and John took to the frog-like position on her back as though he had been born Zulu. Then the little girl bobbed a curtsy to Storm and trotted away, with all her sisters in procession, bearing John off to a wonderland peopled entirely with playmates of endless variety and fascination. On the third day, Storm began sketching, and by the end of the first week she had taken over the household management on a system that Mark referred to as comfortable chaos, alternating with brief periods of pandemonium. Comfortable chaos was when everybody ate what they wanted, perhaps chocolate biscuits and coffee for dinner one night and a feast of barbecued meat the next. They ate it where they felt like it, perhaps sitting up in bed or lying on a rug on the sandbank of the river. They ate when they wanted, breakfast at noon or dinner at midnight, if talking and laughing delayed it that long. Comfortable chaos was when the dusting of furniture or polishing of floors were forgotten in the excitement of living, when clothes that needed mending were tossed into the bottom of the cupboard, when Mark's hair was allowed to grow in points over the back of his collar. Comfortable chaos ended unpredictably and abruptly to be replaced by pandemonium. Pandemonium began when Storm suddenly got a steely look in her eye and announced, "This place is a pigsty," followed by the snipping of scissors, buckets of steaming water, clouds of flying dust, banging pots and flashing needles. Mark was shorn and clad in refurbished clothing. The cottage gleamed and sparkled, and Storm's housekeeping instincts were exhausted for another indefinite period. And the next day she would be up on Spartan's back, John strapped Zulu fashion behind her, following Mark on patrol up the valley. The first time John had been taken on patrol, Mark had asked anxiously, "Do you think it's wise to take him? He's still so very small." And Storm had replied, "I am older and more important than Master John. He fits into my life, not me into his." So John rode patrol on muleback, slept in his apple basket under the stars at night, and took his daily bath in the cool green pools of the Bubezi River, quickly developed an immunity to the occasional tsetse bite, and flourished. They climbed the steep pathway to the summit of Charka's Gate, sat with their feet dangling over that fearful drop, and they looked across the whole valley, the far blue hills and the plains and swamps and the wide winding rivers. "When I first met you, you were poor," Storm said quietly, leaning against Mark's shoulder, with her eyes filled with the peace and wonder of it. "But now you are the richest man in the world, for you are the owner of paradise." He took her up the river to the lonely grave below the escarpment. Storm helped him to build a pile of rocks and to set the cross that Mark had made over it. He told her Pungushi's story of how the old man had been killed, and she cried openly and unashamedly, holding John on her lap, sitting on the gravestone, listening and living every word. "I have looked, but never truly seen before," she said, as he showed her the nest of a sunbird, cunningly woven of lichen and spiderweb, turning it carefully so she could peer into the funnel entrance and see the tiny speckled eggs. "I never knew what true peace was until I came to this place," she said, as they sat on the bank of the Bubezi, in the yellow light of fading day, and watched a kudu bull with long spiral corkscrew horns and chalk-striped shoulders lead his big-eared cows down to the water. "I did not know what happiness was before," she whispered, when they had woken together a little after midnight for no reason, and reached for each other in the darkness. Then one morning she sat up in the rumpled bed, over which John was rampaging unchecked and sowing crumbles of lightly chewed biscuit, and she looked at Mark seriously. "You once asked me to marry you," she said. "Would you like to repeat that question, sir?" And it was later that same day they heard the axeman at work up the valley. The blade of a two-handed axe swung against the bole of a standing hardwood tree rings like a gunshot, and the sound of it bounced against the cliffs of Sharker's Gate and was flung back to break in dying echoes down the valley, each stroke still lingering on the air while the next cracked off the grey cliffs. There was more than one axeman at work, so that the din was continuous, like the sounds of battle. Storm had never before seen such a passion of anger on Mark's face. His skin was drained of blood, so that the tan of the sun was fever yellow, and his lips seemed frostbitten and pinched by the force of it. Yet his eyes blazed, and she had to run to match his angry stride as they went up the scree slope from the river beneath the cliffs, and the sound of the axes broke over them, each separate stroke as brutal and shocking as the ones that preceded it. Ahead of them, one of the lofty leadwoods quivered, as though in agony, and moved against the sky. Mark stopped in mid-stride to watch it, with his head thrown back, and the same agony twisting his own lips. It was a tree of extraordinary symmetry, the silvery trunk rising with such grace as to seem as slim as a young girl's waist. It had taken 200 years to reach its towering height. 70 feet above the ground, it spread into a dark green dome of foliage. As they watched, the tree shuddered again, and the axes fell silent. Slowly, majestically, the leadwood swung into a downward arc, gathering ponderous momentum, and the partially severed trunk groaned and popped as the fibres tore. Faster and faster still she went, crashing through the tops of the lesser vegetation below her, the twisting, tearing wood shrieking like a living thing, until she struck solid earth with a jarring impact they could feel in their guts. The silence lasted many seconds, and then there was the sound of men's voices, awed voices, as though intimidated by the magnitude of the destruction they had wrought. Then, almost immediately after that, the axes started again, fragmenting the great silences of the valley, and Mark began to run. Storm could not keep pace with him. He came out in an area of devastation, a growing swathe of fallen trees where 50 black men worked like ants, half naked and burnished with their own sweat, as they stripped the branches and piled them in windrows for burning. The wood chips shone white as bone in the sunlight, and the sap that oozed from the axe cuts had the sweetest smell of newly spilled blood. At the head of the long, narrow clearing, a single white man crouched to the eyepiece of a theodolite set on its squat tripod. He was aiming the instrument down the clearing and directing with hand signals the setting of brightly painted markers. He straightened from the instrument to face Mark, a young man with a mildly friendly face, thick spectacles in silver wire frames, lank sandy hair flopping onto his forehead. "Oh, hello there," he smiled, and then the smile froze as Mark hissed at him. "Are you in charge here?" "Well, yes, I suppose I am," the young surveyor stuttered. "You are under arrest." "Well, I don't understand." "It's quite simple," Mark blazed at him. "You are cutting standing timber in a proclaimed area. I am the government ranger, and I am placing you under arrest." "Now look here," the surveyor began placatingly, spreading his open hands in a demonstration of his friendly intentions. "I'm just doing my job." In his blind wholesale rage, Mark had not noticed the approach of another man, a heavy, broad-shouldered man, who moved silently out of the uncut brush along the edge of the clearing. However, the thick North Country accent was instantly familiar and struck sparks along the surface of Mark's skin. He remembered Hobday from that day when first he had returned to Andersland to find his world turned upside down. "That's all right, chummy. I'll talk to Mr. Anders." Hobday touched the young surveyor's shoulder placatingly and smiled at Mark, a smile that exposed the short, evenly ground teeth, but was completely lacking in any warmth or humour. "There's nothing you can tell me," Mark started, and Hobday lifted one hand to stop him. "I am here in my official capacity as Provincial Inspector for the Ministry of Lands, Anders. You had better listen." The angry words died, and Mark stared at him, while Hobday calmly unfolded a letter from his wallet and proffered it to Mark. It was typewritten on government paper and signed by the Deputy Minister of Lands. The signature was bold and black. Dirk Courtney. Mark read through the letter slowly, with a plunging sense of despair, and when he finished he handed it back to Hobday. It gave him unlimited powers in the valley, powers backed by all the authority and weight of government. "You're going up in the world," he said, "but still working for the same master." And the man nodded complacently, and then his eyes switched away from Mark's face as Storm came up. The expression on his face changed as he looked at her. Storm had her hair in thick twin braids, dangling forward on each breast. The sun had turned her skin to a rich reddish brown, against which her eyes were startlingly blue and clear. Except for the eyes, she looked like a Sioux princess from some romantic novel. Hobday dropped his eyes slowly over her body, with such intimate lingering insolence that she reached instinctively for Mark's arm and drew closer to him, as though to bring herself under his direct protection. "What is it, Mark?" She was still breathless from her climb up the slope, and high colour lit her cheeks. "What are they doing here?" "They're government men," said Mark heavily, "from the Ministry of Lands." "But they can't cut our trees," she protested, her voice rising. "You've got to stop them, Mark." They're cutting survey lines, Mark explained. They're surveying the valley.
But those trees...
It don't really matter, Mum, Hobday told her. His voice was lower now, with a thick, gloating tone, and his eyes were still busy on her body, like insects crawling greedily to the scent of honey, moving over the thin, sun-bleached cotton that covered her breasts. It don't matter a damn, he repeated. They're all going to be underwater anyway, cut or standing. It's all going under. He turned away from her at last, and swept one hand down the rude clearing. From that side to this, he said, indicating the gap between the towering grey cliffs of Charker's Gate. Right across it. We're going to build the biggest bloody dam in the whole world.